Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This week, actor and Edgar Award-winning playwright Joseph Goodrich reads a story he wrote for EQMM featuring our magazine's founding editor, Frederick Denay, of the Ellery Queen writing team. The story's other lead character is Dashiell Hammett, whom Denay in fact knew and whose class in crime writing he once participated in. That real connection between the two iconic figures of American crime fiction forms the starting point for this fiction about a case they solved together. Here is Joseph Goodrich reading his August 2016 EQMM story, The 10-Cent Murder.
Fred Denay, in a dark gray overcoat and fedora, heavy briefcase swinging at his side, walked quickly along West 10th Street. An editorial meeting at Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine had gone on longer than anticipated, and he was running late. It was 8 minutes after six on an early autumn evening in 1951. The sky was lambent. The trees still had their leaves, obscuring the brick and stone of the buildings that lined the block, but the air was chillier than a week ago. He was glad he'd worn the overcoat. If only he'd brought his scarf. He pressed the buzzer of the garden apartment at number 28 and waited. Dashiell Hammett, tall and painfully thin, with a shock of white hair and a dark mustache, opened the door. He was wearing a crisp white shirt with French cuffs and onyx cufflinks and sharply creased brown slacks. He greeted Fred, who was shorter by at least a foot, hung up his hat and overcoat, and led him from the small foyer into the living room. "Sorry I'm late." "No need to apologize. Drink? Do we have time?" "They'll wait for us." "A small one, then." Dash fixed drinks. Fred sat on a chair near the fireplace. The grate was filled with cigarette butts and crumpled up legal pad pages. He took a scotch and water from Dash. "Thank you." He unbuttoned his jacket and exhaled with a sigh. "Ah, it's good to be here." "How's your day in the city been?" Dash poured a scotch, no water, for himself. Fred sipped his drink. "The train in was late this morning. I missed a meeting with Stanley. Things are crazy at the magazine. I've been trying all day to catch up." "Have you succeeded?" Fred lifted his bulging briefcase and let it drop back to the floor with a thud. "Not until I've read these." Hammett whistled. "Jesus. I just hope there's a decent story in the lot. Two would be better." "Don't push your luck." Fred laughed. "And we get a lot of dreck, it's true." He took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes. "You all right?" "Oh, headache." He massaged his temples. "I've had it all day." "Sure you want to come to class tonight? You wouldn't rather head back to Larchmont and get some rest?" "I promised I'd be there," Fred said doggedly, "and I'll be there." "I appreciate it. I know the students are looking forward to meeting you." Fred put his glasses on. "Any writers in the class?" "Too soon to tell. They should have a character assignment ready for tonight. That'll help sort out the sheep from the lambs." "How many students this time around?" "Three." Fred was surprised. "Only three? Students have been scared away from the school." "My God, these are perilous times." "They're getting worse." Dash sat in the chair across from Fred and lit a cigarette. He gestured to a yellow legal pad and several typewritten pages on the coffee table. "I've spent my day working on that." Light danced in Fred's eyes. "A new story?" "A begging letter. It's for the school. They asked me to take a look at it." He smiled. "I'm nothing but a glorified proofreader these days." "May I?" "Be my guest." Fred leaned forward and collected the typewritten pages. He adjusted his glasses, then started reading. "The Jefferson School of Social Science was founded in 1944 and occupies a 9-story building in downtown Manhattan. It is an adult evening school that teaches Marxism, the philosophy and social science of the working class. It analyzes the nature of capitalist and socialist society and studies the general laws of social change with special emphasis on the United States." Hammett watched him, smoke unfurling from his cigarette. "Today, the United States Department of Justice is trying to shut down the Jefferson School. The first time in history, our government has moved to close a school on the basis of what it teaches. Such thought control measures are not new in this period of the Cold War. Many Americans have fallen victim to the growing menace of McCarthyism." Fred looked up from the page. They can't actually shut it down, can they? Before Dash could answer, the telephone rang. He tossed his cigarette into the fireplace, crossed the room, and picked up the receiver. Oregon 33797, he said. A voice buzzed on the other end. Fred watched Dash listening to his caller, then went back to the typewritten page. They include teachers and students, trade union leaders, writers and publishers, artists and entertainers, leaders of the Negro people, and foreign-born persons who have lived here for decades. Thousands have been investigated by congressional committees, hounded by the FBI, pilloried in the press, fired from their jobs, deported, barred from travel abroad, or sent to prison on the basis of what they think and advocate, or what they are suspected of thinking. Fred took another sip of his scotch and water. The drive to intimidate the nonconformists of our time has become so severe that what Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas calls the black silence of fear has begun to settle over the people of our country. Much of this drive against so-called subversives has been directed against our democratic right to teach, and I'll be there as soon as I can, Dash said. Fred looked up. He could tell from Dash's expression that something was wrong. He set the page aside. Dash dropped the receiver into its cradle. He took a long swig of scotch and lit another cigarette. What's happened? Dash exhaled smoke. Can they shut the place down? Isn't that what you asked just before the phone rang? That's right. Their chances just got a hell of a lot better. Dash downed the rest of his scotch. That was Peggy Parsons, one of the board members. There's been a murder.
At the school?
Yes. Dash flicked his cigarette into the fireplace and got to his feet. They want me to talk to the police. He left the room. Fred stood up and walked to the bedroom door. Dash stood at the mirror, tying his tie with quick, efficient movements. Who's been killed?
One of the staff members.
Do they have any idea who did it?
Dash slipped into a tan and black checked sports coat. They think it was one of my students.
He crossed into the foyer and put on his hat and overcoat.
There won't be any class tonight. You can get an early train home.
Are you kidding me? Fred, briefcase in hand, bustled into the foyer. He grabbed his overcoat.
I'm coming with you. I wouldn't miss this for the world.
I'll be glad to have you there. And from what Peggy told me, it sounds like this murder is right up your alley.
How do you mean?
Dash would say nothing more. Fred slapped his hat on and followed him out of the apartment. The black and yellow Plymouth Deluxe taxicab let them out in front of the Jefferson School of Social Science, a nondescript building at 16th and 6th. They showed their identification to a policeman, massive in his brass-buttoned tunic and cap, and got into the self-service elevator. Dash pushed the button for the 7th floor. The elevator ground its way upward.
"We're lucky," he said, breaking the silence he'd maintained since leaving West 10th Street.
"We are?"
Dash gave Fred a grim smile. Usually the elevator's out of order.
While they waited for Detective McAlpine, Dash and Fred talked with Margaret Parsons in an empty classroom. Mrs. Parsons was a striking, dark-haired woman in her early 40s who favored dungarees and pearls. She came from old money and had new ideas about how to spend it. She funded organizations dedicated to social justice, the improvement of race relations, American-Soviet friendship, and a dozen other causes. She taught an evening class in dialectical materialism and, like Dash, was on the school's board. At 6:20, Mrs. Parsons had found the body of Morris Rabinowitz, the school's registrar, lying dead on the floor of his office, a letter opener protruding from his neck. Rabinowitz's desk had been forced open and searched. Only one thing was missing— a list of the students currently enrolled in the school. Mrs. Parsons had notified the police and then called Dash.
"You see how horrible this is," Mrs. Parsons said. "Not only is Mr. Rabinowitz dead, but the student list is gone."
"What's so important about the list?" Fred asked.
Dash lit a cigarette. "The school guards that list carefully. If it fell into the wrong hands, it could be used to blacklist or blackmail the students on it. We may do away with keeping any lists at all." Mrs. Parsons drew her mink tighter about her. "If this doesn't close us down for good."
Dash aimed a plume of smoke toward the ceiling.
"They think it was one of my students?"
"Yes. They were all seen around Mr. Rabinowitz's office within 20 minutes of the time I found him.
between 5:20 and 5:40 or so.
That's right.
No one else was around?
No. It looks like whoever killed poor Mr. Rabinowitz is one of your students.
Who saw them? Fred said.
Bridie, the cleaning woman.
Where are they now? Hammond asked. Mrs. Parsons gestured toward one of the faded green walls.
In one of the classrooms, waiting to be questioned.
Who are they? Fred said. What are their names?
Dash held up a finger for each student.
Penny Meyer, Brendan Nickel, Salvatore Corda.
Wait a second. Penny, Nickel, Corda? Their names are all coins, or damn near. You've got to be kidding me.
I wish I was.
And that's not all.
Mrs. Parsons twisted her strand of pearls. Mr. Rabinowitz was found with a dime clutched in his hand.
A dying clue?
Fred shook his head in disbelief. This is like something out of one of the Queen stories.
Now you see why I'm glad you're here, Dash said.
Ellery would know what to do. I'm afraid I don't.
If only Ellery Queen were here, Mrs. Parsons said. He could solve the murder and save the school.
Fred looked thoughtful.
Would it really?
Mrs. Parsons sighed deeply.
At this point, Mr. Dene, anything would help.
Fred paced. Hammett watched him, amused. He could see the wheels turning in Fred's mind.
Fred stopped abruptly. I wonder, he said, if Detective McAlpine would let us talk with the students?
It turned out that McAlpine, a long gray figure in a blue serge suit and a snap-brim fedora, would, but only after he'd questioned them. After a long wait, Fred, Dash, and Mrs. Parsons were taken to the glum trio of students. Penny Meyer was in her late 20s, with ash-blonde hair and a deep tan left over from the summer. She was dressed in a bright red tam-o'-shanter, a black turtleneck sweater, a red and black plaid skirt, and black flats. Brendan Nickel was also in his late 20s. He wore a camel's hair sport coat, blue shirt and tie, chino trousers and brown loafers. A crew haircut and horn-rimmed glasses heightened his resemblance to Call Me Madam's Russell Knipe. Salvatore Corda was the odd man out. He was well into his 50s, heavy-set, with a dark complexion and a working man's hands. His suit was off the rack, and his shoes were badly in need of a polish. He was sweating. He looked up from a manuscript held together with a large silver paperclip, then quickly looked down again.
Penny stood up. "Mr. Hammett, isn't it terrible what happened? We couldn't be more upset about it all."
Nickel and Corda followed Penny's lead and stood. Dash introduced Fred. Penny said it was an honor to meet him and how nice it was of him to come to Mr. Hammett's mystery writing class. Nickel expressed the hope that Mr. Dene would return when things had settled down. Corda told Fred how much he'd enjoyed The Origin of Evil and asked, "Are you working on another mystery?"
"I'm working on one now," Fred said, smiling.
He chatted for another couple of minutes with the students, asking them about their work and their lives, while Dash and Mrs. Parsons watched. Then he crossed to Dash and said in an undertone,
"I think I'm on to something."
Dash whispered back,
"What?"
They talked together quietly for a time.
"I noticed that too," Dash said.
"Do you want to handle it?"
Dash shook his head.
"No, my detective days are over."
"Then I'll ask McAlpine to check on it."
Fred stepped into the hall. A uniformed officer took him to McAlpine. Fred made his request. McAlpine removed his hat and scratched his head.
"The Hall of Records is closed for the day."
"Can you get someone to open it up?"
"I could, but I need a damned good reason."
"I think I can give you one." Fred told McAlpine what he'd told Dash. McAlpine listened intently, then hurried off down the hall. Fred rejoined Dash and Mrs. Parsons. "McAlpine's calling now. He thinks it'll take about an hour to get an answer."
"What is it you're waiting to find out about?" Mrs. Parsons said.
"A wedding ring," Fred said.
A wedding ring? Why?"
"Unless I'm greatly mistaken, one is missing."
"Who's missing one?"
"One of the students."
Mrs. Parsons looked puzzled. "But none of them is married. I heard you asking them about that. So how can a wedding ring be missing?"
Fred refused to say another word. Frustrated, Mrs. Parsons turned to Dash.
"Do you know what he's talking about?"
"Yes, but I'm not telling either."
"Ah, you're impossible." She sat down at one of the desks and folded her arms.
"So what am I supposed to do for an hour?"
Dash brought out his pack of cigarettes.
"Smoke if you got 'em."
Conversation had run out 10 minutes before McAlpine and a uniformed officer entered. McAlpine hurried over to Fred and said something to him under his breath. Fred nodded, and McAlpine took a seat. Fred stood up. Every eye turned to him. He adjusted his glasses and cleared his throat. "Ladies and gentlemen, Detective McAlpine has very kindly given me the floor. It's been a long evening for us all, so I'll try to wrap things up here as quickly as possible." But he took his time before he spoke. "Morris Rabinowitz was murdered tonight by someone who wanted the list of students currently attending the Jefferson School. I don't know why the killer wanted it, but Mr. Hammett and Mrs. Parsons assure me there are some very good, or should I say very bad, reasons for stealing such a list. There's a lot I don't know. I never knew Mr. Rabinowitz, for instance, though I'm sorry he's dead. John Donne was right. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Mr. Rabinowitz's death diminishes everyone in this room, even his killer." McAlpine muttered something under his breath, but Fred paid no attention. "I certainly don't know where the list is. It may be hidden somewhere on the premises. It may be tucked into a shoe or a briefcase, though I presume you've all been searched, or will be. I only know two things. The first is that there are three suspects, all students in Mr. Hammett's mystery writing class. The second is that I was lied to this evening." Fred slowly approached Penny Meyer and fixed his gaze on her. The young woman looked up at him with a blank, pleasant expression. "By whom, Mr. Dene?" "By you, Miss Meyer, for starters." The young woman frowned. "I don't know what you mean. I haven't told any lies." "Earlier this evening, you said you're not married." "I didn't lie. I'm not." "You got a lovely tan this summer, Miss Meyer," Fred said.
Thank you. I spent a lot of time at the beach."
"I can see you did. And that's why I couldn't help noticing the white band of skin on the fourth finger of your left hand. That strip of untanned skin is exactly where a wedding ring would be. But you said you weren't married. My only conclusion is that you lied to me. Unless you have another explanation?" The young woman was silent, lips pursed, and she studied the toe of her left shoe as if by concentrating hard enough she could make the room and everyone in it disappear. "Do you have another explanation?" Fred was gentle, but remorseless. "If you do, I'd like to hear it."
"So would I," growled McAlpine.
"Well, Miss Meyer, do you have an alternate explanation?" The dark head nodded. "Yes, I have." The young woman's voice wasn't much louder than a whisper. "But I wish I didn't have to tell you."
"Why is that?"
"Because it's..." Penny faltered, licked her lips, tried again. It's too painful." She looked up at Fred, her dark eyes liquid with sorrow. "You were right, Mr. Dene. I did lie to you. I was married. It was foolish to try to hide it from you. I'm sorry, but it's just so hard to talk about..." A tear ran down her cheek. "About Jimmy."
"Jimmy?"
"Jimmy McKelway," Penny said with a sigh. "He was a soldier. We were married just before he was sent to Korea. He died in the Battle of Taejon. It was only the other day I decided to stop wearing his ring." She lifted up her left hand, fingers outspread, then let it drop back onto her lap. "He was a hero, my Jimmy, and I loved him. But I have to live my own life." Her voice throbbed. "You understand that, don't you, Mr. Dene? It's not bad of me, is it? It can't be. I loved him, but I have to be free." Fred studied the young woman as she shakily dug a handkerchief out of her purse and wiped at her eyes. "That's a very touching story, Miss Meyer. It'd be even more touching if it were true." Brendan Nichols sprang to his feet. "How dare you speak to her like that? Hasn't she been through enough without..." Detective McAlpine cut him off. "You'll get a chance to talk, don't worry. For the moment, why don't you just sit down and shut up?" The young man sat, staring daggers at McAlpine, who, unfazed, gestured to Fred. "Go on, Mr. Dene." Fred's tone was mild. "As I was saying, Miss Meyer, your husband isn't dead, and he was never a soldier in Korea. According to the Hall of Records, your husband is very much alive. In fact, he's sitting right next to you.
His name is Brendan Nickel. That's ludicrous, the young man said. I didn't even know Miss Meyer until I met her in Mr. Hammett's class. We're not married. We never have been, and as far as I know, we never will be. I wish you'd get that through your heads.
Fred turned to Hammett. Good, isn't he?
Hammett exhaled smoke.
He's good. He's very good. I like the note of righteous indignation he worked into it. It's very effective. I almost believe him.
Mrs. Parsons stirred at Hammett's side.
Oh, why don't you?
The records, Hammett said. Right, Fred?
Exactly.
Fred looked at the young man, who sat glowering at his desk.
The records show that you and Miss Meyer are married. Why you both chose to conceal it, why Miss Meyer isn't wearing her ring, I don't know. But I do know this. Judging by the paperback books and newspapers on his desk, Mr. Rabinowitz loved games and crossword puzzles and wordplay. Unable to speak due to a wound in the throat, he still managed to leave a clue to his killer's identity. As he was dying, he dug into his jacket pocket and picked out a coin, which was found in his clenched fist.
Fred stuffed his hand into his jacket pockets and made a slow circle of the room.
A coin! Doesn't that strike you as strange? I mean, we have a room full of coins here, don't we?
Penny Meyer, Brendan Nickel, and, stretching things a little, Salvatore Quarta.
But the coin we found in Mr. Rabinowitz's hand was a dime. How could a dime tell us who killed him?
I asked Detective McAlpine what kind of change Mr. Rabinowitz had in his pockets. He told me, 2 dimes and a half dollar, nothing else. So Mr. Rabinowitz chose the dime on purpose. But what was that purpose? Who did Mr. Rabinowitz identify as his killer?
He peered at Hammett. Dash?
Hammett might have raised an eyebrow a fraction of an inch, and he might not have, but he said nothing.
Mrs. Parsons?
Mrs. Parsons shrugged.
I haven't the slightest, Mr. Dene.
Neither did I, Fred said, until I found out that Penny and Brendan are married. Then it all fell into place.
He crossed to the two young people.
Mr. Rabinowitz identified you as clearly as if he'd spoken your names. Do you know how he did it?
Penny looked sideways at Brendan.
Do you?
Brendan opened his mouth to speak.
Before he could say a word, Fred slapped a coin onto Penny's desk. Everyone in the room, even McAlpine and the uniformed officer, jumped at the thwack of flesh and metal meeting wood.
Rabinowitz identified his killers with a dime, Fred said, pointing at the coin.
For after all, what is a dime but 2 nickels?
It didn't take McAlpine long to get the details. Brendan Nickel and Penny Meyer had been searching Rabinowitz's desk when the registrar returned unexpectedly. They tried to talk him out of calling the police, but Rabinowitz wouldn't give in. Brendan grabbed him when he tried to leave. They struggled. Penny stabbed him in the neck with the letter opener from the desk. They thought he was dead, but he wasn't. Not quite. They'd hidden the list in a desk in an empty classroom and planned to sell it to one of the rabid anti-communist organizations that had sprung up over the last few years. As the school registrar, Rabinowitz knew that Meyer and Nickel were married. Penny often went by her maiden name. She and Nickel were experts at the Badger game and frequently posed as brother and sister. But that was over now. It was all over now. A week later, Salvatore Quarta had dinner with Fred and Dash at the Garden Apartment on West 10th. As 2/3 of the students had been arrested and the class had been canceled, Dash felt he owed Quarta something. After a steak dinner, drink in hand, Quarta read his short story aloud. Fred and Dash offered their critique. It wasn't bad, not bad at all. Some things to fix, some things to think about, but not bad. As he was buttoning his overcoat, Quarta said, "Say, Mr. Dene, I was wondering." He pulled a flat cap out of an overcoat pocket and put it on. "If I was to write up what happened last week at the school as a kind of story, as a piece of fiction, like, I was wondering if maybe you'd think about putting it in EQMM? If it was any good, of course."
"Stranger things have happened," Fred said.
They made their goodbyes and, talking 19 to the dozen, walked off into the chilly autumn darkness. Dash locked the door behind them and sank onto the sofa. He lit a cigarette and smoked it in the ringing silence of the apartment. He poured himself another drink and went into a small study off the bedroom.
A typewriter with a blank sheet of paper rested on a small table. He sat in front of it and contemplated the keys with that old familiar ache. Maybe tonight. Maybe tonight.
The 10-Cent Murder is copyrighted by Joseph Goodrich. Music for the podcast, performed by Andre Previn, is in the public domain and was obtained from the community audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM. Thank you.